I would like to introduce our speaker for the night, Brian.
Like this? That's good? Is everybody good? Then why are you here? My name is Brian. I'd like to thank John. Are you here? Who asked me to? There you go, John. Thank you very much for asking me to speak this meeting. This is a meeting that saved my life. I learned in Al-Anon not to be dramatic, and when I tell you this meeting saved my life, I mean this meeting saved my life. So those people here are new, or if you're old, or fairly new, and you don't see any hope, well, that's what I came in with. No hope at all. So, I'll start at the beginning. When I was in the third grade, they moved my desk into the principal's office. And then in the fourth grade, when the police came to arrest me out of school, my mother knew it was going to be a long road. That was my third school in 4 years, and my mother had me wear, it was the 60s, and my mother had me wear a suit every time I went to a new school because she thought I was fooling somebody. So everybody else was wearing paisley and tie-dye, and I would show up in a suit. So I wasn't allowed on the schoolyard because of fighting. So my mother would have to come and pick me up at lunch and take me home. So I wasn't allowed to be there because when I fought with kids, I didn't get kids in headlocks. I hit them with trash cans and kicked them and did things that people at that age didn't usually do. And when I start there, I want to always let everybody know I was never a tough guy. I was scared all the time. And if someone embarrassed me or shamed me, or if I got scared, I'd just start swinging. But people always thought I was some sort of tough guy, and that saved me going through school, because a lot of the tough guys, the guys who were really tough, they let me hang around because they thought I was crazy, you know, and I guess I was. I got kicked out of the school where my desk was in the principal's office because I bought a switchblade to school in the third grade, and I showed my friend, and he ran and told somebody that I was trying to stab him. And this was my close friend. Now, I'm going to tell you, honest to God, it was a 1-inch switchblade. And so these are how stories get started. So as I went from school to school, they said that Brian was crazy and people avoided me. And I liked that because I was scared. When I was 6 years old, we had a house remodeled, and there was a sliding glass door. And every night I had my mother tuck in a stuffed animal on the side where the sliding glass door was, because the people I knew that were coming in to kill me would kill the animal first. So that's the baggage I brought to the world. And you know, I blame my parents for that for a long time, until we had a son and treated him different than my parents treated me, and he still had his own issues, because we come into life with issues. But again, I thought it was my parents. My parents had one perfect son. He was older than I was, and then I came along. And so my mother, who was not an alcoholic, tried to fix me from day one. And she took me to all the doctors. She took me to UCLA Medical Center. She took me to Child Guidance Clinic on the USC campus. They put me on drugs. I remember getting sleep tests, electrodes in the head, everything. They put me on Ritalin. But if you weren't hyperactive or whatever the disorder was, then it was just speed. And my mom would come in the middle of the night, and I'd just be doing puppet shows because I was on speed, you know. And then they tried Thorazine on a six-year-old. So, you know, I held that against my mom for a long time, and we'll get to the point where I didn't. But she tried to fix me. Her mother was a horrible person, a really, really effed up person, and her stepfather was a terrible alcoholic. He used to try to molest her. He would give her a haircut, and then he'd be drunk, and he cut the top of her ear off once and told her just to shut up, quit crying. And I just tell that for all the people who did grow up in alcoholic families. It may not be typical, but we all know terrible things happen to children in alcoholic families, and that's where my mother came from. My father was not an alcoholic either. And I thought, being that his parents were from Ireland, I thought it was odd we didn't have a lot of alcoholics in the family. And then my dad, one day in passing, mentioned that he had three uncles that drank themselves to death. So there is some, problem in the family. So, but they didn't, of course, they didn't talk about it. I excelled in sports, and so that kind of saved me. So I had a lot of friends, but when I would play sports, I got kicked out of a lot of games. I got kicked out of baseball games because I'd strike out and I'd get embarrassed and I'd just start cussing. And I'd throw the bat and they'd kick me out and I would just cuss at the top of my lungs. And I look back and I wonder what those parents were thinking now. I look back and I wonder what they were thinking about what I was doing. And I know I get a laugh when I said the desk is in the principal's office, but as I get more into recovery, I'm very sad for that little boy who couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. It was a different person, but I couldn't stop. I would get notes sent home. I would get reports sent home in the sixth grade to my father, and it had different categories. And if I got disrespectful, I got beat. And I get disrespectful three times a week. And it just became a habit, So, that's what it was like. So I had trouble all through school, and I never turned in my tests because I knew I was stupid, and I knew if you read my test, that you would know it too. So I did not fill out the tests and didn't turn them in. So, it's funny, I went to Catholic school for a while. That was a joy. It was tough enough. I went back and forth between the Catholic schools and public schools between being asked to leave and whatnot. But it's funny, just recently, there was a nun named Sister Breach Boyle. She was from Ireland. And she was fair with me. And I've been looking to go. She's down in San Diego. I found I want to go down and just say thank you. It's not an amends thing. I'm sure I could make amends to her, but I just thought, it was pretty rough. Not that the other teachers were supposed to do anything different. I mean, I just couldn't shut up in class. I'd run around. I just do things. It's funny because my son had that same thing, but he seemed to be charming about it. They didn't, I didn't put his desk in the principal's office. But as I get into recovery, I feel bad for that little boy who couldn't stop, and I think about some of the positive people I had along the lines. Though I no longer blame the other ones because I don't know what they were supposed to do, because nobody else in class was acting like that. And I got into high school, and because of Sister Breach, I was allowed. I got into Notre Dame High School and then Sherman Oaks. It was a big deal. It was a big sports school, and I played played football, basketball, ran track, and that helped me kind of keep focused until the and I got 147 detentions one year. So when you got enough of them, they just have you come in Saturdays and just work around the school all day. It was what it was. But the thing about that was I had a good teacher. Unfortunately, he passed away. I had two good teachers who passed away young. I would have liked to have talked to them too. And there was one guy in the neighborhood. There was one parent in the neighborhood named Seymour Eisner. And he's gone. He's long gone. But he used to tell my parents, he's going to be okay. He'd say he's just, it's just who he is, and he's going to be okay. And that's the only adult I ever heard say that about me. But I had a couple teachers that supported me, and who knows, I got good grades in their classes. But, you know, there's places now for people who were like I was at that time. There's other alternative learning centers. And there was a young woman I know involved in what I do for a living. And she said that they tried to put her in remedial courses, but her mother was an educator, and she went to a special school and ended up getting 2 degrees in junior college at the age of 16. And then entered UCLA as a senior at the age of 17. And they wanted to put her in remedial courses. I mean, so there are starting to be places. And you know what? I mention that because I'm really happy for her. I'm really happy she didn't have to go through what I went through. I'm really, and I don't hold resentment about what happened before. I'm just glad to see people who are different getting a chance to be. So I was at Notre Dame High School. My brother was a 4-0 student, an all-state athlete, and was going off to play football at an Ivy League school. And when he left, they called me in the office and said, well, when your brother was here, we didn't want to embarrass him, but now that he's gone, could you go too? So I left, and I went to Hollywood High. And, you know, and I played sports. And so I got on the team. I had a girlfriend that went there, which is why I went there. And I got on the team, and it was summer league, so I got to meet all the guys, and we were playing summer league, and it was really a great game, and I played really well. And towards the end of the game, I made kind of a crazy shot and put us within one, and they had the ball, and I was playing defense, and I slapped at the ball, got a foul, but it was really good. I was really happy. It was really intense. And the guy, they called the family. The guy took the ball. He threw it in my chest, and I just knocked him out. And my mom was in the stands, and she was like, "You know, I just can't go anywhere." And again, he embarrassed me. I hit him, and he went down. And it was again, I have to keep reiterating: not a tough guy, just scared and reactionary. And by this time, it had become just a way of life. So I was playing basketball against Fairfax High. I had friends there. I got embarrassed during the game. The coach pulled me out, so I took off my jersey, and I threw it in his face, and I left. And I left school because there was no reason to go back to school because I was... you know, I wasn't playing sports anymore. So my mother, I was really suffering from depression at this time. And I sat in the house and I listened to meditation tapes and I slept like 18 hours. But back then, they didn't know what it was. At least they didn't tell me they knew what it was. I just thought it was freaking out. I was having panic attacks all night and sleeping all day. I had tinfoil on the windows and I didn't go out. I lived across the street from a park. All the friends would come over and hang out with me. So, you know, I was kind of cool, but I was really agoraphobic, and I had depression. This went on for a few years. But at that time, the beginning of that, my mom thought it would be a good idea for me to go back to Notre Dame and go back a year and be with all my friends' brothers. And I went because I was panicky and I was depressed and I was just really in a fragile state of mind. So I said okay, and I went back there, and I know again she was trying to do the right thing, but it just didn't work for me. It was one more embarrassing situation, you know. And they asked me to leave, and they were really angry when they asked me to leave because they'd give me a second chance, but I wasn't going to do anything out of second chance. I just wasn't any good in school, and I'm not. You know, my mother always wanted me to go back to school, but I'm not. I'm not good in school, and that's okay, because today I'm good at what I do. But it wasn't school, you know, but it was so important to her. She grew up in the Depression in the South Bronx, and she just thought, you know, education was better. You know, I mean, it's good. Not like education's bad, I'm up here, you know. Just say no to school. But it wasn't for me. But, you know, I got married, you know, pretty early on. And to a woman who every man in her life was an alcoholic. And so the relationship was great for a while. And, you know, because my mother had done everything for me, everything for me. She went shopping for me. She bought everything for me. I used to steal headlights out of cars to replace them in my car because I didn't actually know you could just go buy them. Now, you may not understand that, but I walk in like Macy's now and I look around and say, hey, I could get a shirt here, you know? But my whole life, my mother did everything up until she died, and that was about 6.5 years ago. And I was in recovery and I was working on these issues. But she was involved in doing everything for me, making appointments. There's people in here who know what I'm talking about, you know. Your parents just did everything for you. So, so I married a woman who did everything for me. And when she, and when I needed her to do something and she didn't do it right, I yelled at her. You know, because I wanted it done a certain way, but I couldn't do it. I was too afraid. I didn't make phone calls to have people pick up the phone that you didn't know. I didn't do that. And so I made her do that. And we had a son who's just the love of my life. And because of this program, I have a great relationship with him now. We work together during the week. We hang out. He's 23. And it's just great. It's just great. And we're divorced. Not me and my son. I mean, me and my... We're divorced, and we have been for 12 years. And we get along, but that's a constant, you know, it's a constant working of the program. You know, I was talking about that on Sunday at a sponsee meeting, but I'll talk more about that. But, you know, it was, we started a business. It was went really well for a long time, and just the Al-Anonism just reared its head, and I had no idea. I had no idea what it was, and then she ended up leaving. We were watching TV one night, true story, watching TV, sitting on the couch, and she said, "This isn't working," and I said, "Oh, what do you want to see?" And she said, "No, us." And I said, she said, "We haven't been getting along." I said, "I know. But, you know, we've worked through some things." And her mother had passed away. It was really unfortunate because Mom was kind of a buffer. I loved her mother, and I liked her mother. I liked her mother more than I liked my mother. You know, she was a really interesting woman. My mother was a great woman. You know, don't get me wrong. Just she wasn't able to have a regular conversation with me. She was so anxious and anxiety-ridden about me being happy that she couldn't have a conversation with me. And I'd see her have conversations with other people, and I'd say, why can't I have that? You know? She wasn't able to do that. So my mother-in-law, we went to movies together, we hung out, it was different. But my mother was one of the first and only female chiropractors in New York City in the 40s. She put herself through 9 years of night school. She worked in a factory. I mean, she was really a tremendous person with a strong drive. And again, she wanted to fix me, which wasn't going to happen. So I got married, and then my father was elderly, and he passed away, and then my mother was completely handicapped, and she moved in with us, and my ex left. And I said, wait a minute, but it was your idea, you know, for her to come in. And so it was a tough time. I had my mom for 5 years in the house, and you know, it was a rough road. I had people come in and take care of her. But I had to take care of her a lot. I had to take her out a lot. And at this time, I was really into depression again. And I was really overweight. And, you know, I was just uncomfortable in life. And I slept most of the day again. And my mother lived with me. And I would take her to the doctor. And one time, when I tell this story... One time I was getting her out of the car, it was really hot, and I was always embarrassed about my weight, so I was wearing multiple sweatshirts and a beanie. It was about 105 out, and I was taking her out of the car, And she started screaming in my ear because she was afraid I was going to drop her. And I said to her, "Mother, if I could kill you right now and get away with it, I would." And I say that because I've talked to people over the years who have had similar experiences with their sick parents. And I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just saying that sometimes we get like that through fear, through whatever it is. And I told her, I apologized to her, and this is not a joke. She had early stages of Alzheimer's, and she really didn't remember, but that wasn't the point. You know, the point was the way I was treating her and the fear I had, and I was always anxious driving her around because, yeah, I thought I was going to drop her, you know. And so she was wheelchair bound, and, you know, and at home she was bedridden. I'm going to have to take her out a lot. So I got here. I could sit here. I was thinking, I don't always know exactly what I'm going to say, except the early part. I know what happened in school. That's always the same. But when I talk, I could sit here and talk about all the guys in the room and what they mean to me and who has touched me in a specific way. I could just go through and tell a few minutes on what they've meant to my life and how I've changed and how now I can buy headlights at the store instead of stealing them, and how I've opened another business and how I deal with my son and my ex. And it's all about recovery now. That's where I came from. I came from depression. Oh, I forgot this part. My first meeting here, I was at a friend's house. I'd known him for years, and guys were asking me if there was meetings in my neighborhood. I said, "Oh yeah, there's meetings in my neighborhood." And they were like, "Al-Anon meetings?" And I was like, "Oh." And so three or four guys came up to me and said, "Do I know a good Al-Anon meeting?" And I went to my friend and I said, "All these guys are looking for Al-Anon meetings. Are they gay?" I thought Al-Anon was for women and gay men. And that's not to get a laugh, that's to tell my ignorance about this program that I needed so desperately. That is my first program that I didn't know at that time. And my friend said to me, he said, "I go to Al-Anon." I said, "Why do you go to Al-Anon?" He said, "It helped me with my anger." I was blown away. I couldn't believe it. What I was doing at that time in my life was leaving the house every day looking for an altercation. Every day, I was leaving the house looking for an altercation. The last day before I came in here, I was pulling a guy out of his car on Moore Park in Fulton, and I had him halfway out. He thought it was funny to laugh at me as I was trying to break his window, then he hadn't locked his door. So I opened his door, and he changed the look on his face. And I was pulling him out of the car, and God literally tapped me on the shoulder and said, "What are you going to do this time? What are you going to do this time?" And I let him go. I set him back in the car. I got in my car, and I drove to where I was doing a play, and I got in a fist fight with the director. So every day I left the house, I was looking for a fight of some sort. I was looking for an altercation. And so when he said that it helped him with his anger, I just knew I had to go try it. I didn't know why. I just knew that I couldn't go on living the way I was, and I'd been this way my whole life, as I said, with the children on the playground, and I just knew it was never going to change. And I sat in the house with my windows covered with no light in there, and I never had any lights on in the house, and I sat in there and I sat on the bed every day contemplating suicide. Because I said, if it's not going to get any better than this, then why be here? And it had been like that my whole life. And when he said that, I thought, who would mention desperation up here? You know, whoever talked about desperation, it was like, I was desperate. I was desperate to change, and I didn't know I could. But I was like, well, I might as well go check, because it ain't working this way. And so I came up, and the meeting was in the back. He told me it was a legendary men's group. And the meeting was in the back, and all these women are walking in. And I'm like, who let the broads in? What's I thought this was a men's group, so I was nervous, and I wondered if I was in the right place, so I called him, he made fun of me, I got angry. You know, that's the pattern. Do you see a pattern here? And so, but I came back, and they had an off-site, and he said I should go. And I didn't want to go, because I was scared. I was scared. Who's going to be my roommate? I don't know the person. I snore. Do they snore? If I don't sleep, I'm going to be anxious. I can't go. I don't have any money because I don't have a job. And he said, well, we have scholarships here. I said, I can't take anything from anybody. Are you kidding me? And he said, well, I pay for one of the scholarships. And I said, okay, if you pay for it, because I know you, then I could go. And so I went, and how it goes in God's world, my roommate didn't show up the first night, so I was able to sleep. I was able to listen to the meetings and hear all the love and the people. I met Willie there. I heard him talk. And I said, this is someone I can trust. Didn't have a lot of trust. Didn't know I was looking for trust. I certainly didn't know I was looking for love. I certainly didn't know I was looking to find a room of men that I could tell them I love them and they'd say they love me. I did not know I was looking for that. I did not know that. That is what would change my life. So I met him and called him up and we started talking. And then I didn't call him all the time right away because I figured I'd be bothering him. And we all know how that goes. And, you know, now that I've been around for a while, when people call me, I am so grateful when people call me. Bruce called me, and he was going through some stuff. And I'm so happy he called, you know. I get like a little kid. I get like an idiot. I'm like, thanks, Bruce. Hey, man, you called me, you know. And we laugh and we talk. And he was going through something pretty serious. We talked a few times. And I understand how it is now, but I didn't know at the time. And he actually said, he said, you know, when I'm really busy here and you guys call me, it gives me a chance to get out of what I'm doing and take a break. Whether that's true or not, I believe him, you know. And so I started calling more and more. And then my life started turning around. I'll tell you how God works. You know, I'll mention that quite a few times as I speak. I was in a bank cashing a check, and it was Bank of America across from the, the Barefoot meeting on Pass? And at Bank of America right there, and they wanted to charge $5, and I was broke. They wanted to charge $5 to cash a check, but I couldn't have a bank account because I was messed up. And they wanted to charge $5, so there I was with my beanie and my multiple sweatshirts and my long goatee and just scary looking, just standing in the middle of the bank screaming, you're ripping me off. With my hands at my side screaming, you're ripping me off! You guys are ripping me off! Okay? So cut to a year and a half later, I've been in the program for a while and I go in there to cash checks and they're like $5. And I said, sure, okay, that's the deal, you know. And I turn around, and there's some guy standing in the middle of the bank screaming, you're ripping me off. Standing with his hands at his side, screaming out loud, you're ripping me off. And I'm looking, and I'm like, that was me. That was me a year and a half ago. And it started to change. The first time it really changed for me is a truck cut me off getting onto the freeway. And I didn't chase it, you know, and I was just driving on. I was all calm and I was heading up the off ramp and I was like, wow, I didn't chase that guy, you know, and that was the first time that I knew that things were changing. And then as it went on and on and on, and I deal with my ex-wife on a regular basis because my son grew up with her and she's very smart. She's a fantastic mother. Look, if she didn't leave me, I would have put a gun in my mouth. I mean, it was not good because I had no recovery and I was just living that same life. And she left and I had nothing to do but get better or die. You know, it wasn't that was the two choices. So, I mean, she when our son was a junior in high school, I said, let him walk home every day. I want him to get some exercise because he played video games. She goes, no, this is when kids are going to drop out of school. You pick him up every day. You know, she's giving me orders. We've been divorced. And I was like, okay. And I picked him up every day. He hung around with like five or six kids, and three of them dropped out of school. You know? I just listened to what she had to say. I started getting that recovery and just, maybe this is okay. Maybe I don't have to fight all the time. I learned in here to answer the question asked. I called her up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I was going to go paint a house, and she had sold windows to this person. And I needed to know if I had to get primer or just paint, if they came primered. And so I called her up, and I made kind of a joke when she answered the phone. She said, what do you want? You know, instead of saying, what the fuck do you want? I said, I answered the question asked. I said, oh, I need to know if the windows are primered. She said, hang on. And she checked and said they were. And that was a big turnaround in my life for me, was answering the question asked without 15 years, at that time, 20 years of baggage. You know, just answer the simple question. And things started getting better for there. Look, I'm not saying I'm a saint, it works every time, but for the most of the time, every day I left the house, I was looking for trouble. And every day I leave the house now, I'm not looking for trouble. And it is so rare that it happens to me nowadays, you know? So that was a big part. I went over to make amends to her once because I realized that I wasn't there emotionally in the marriage. I didn't show up. I never had sex outside the marriage, so I don't know why she left. All men understand that. Women know there's other reasons, you know. But I didn't understand. But I knew I never had sex outside the marriage, so I knew I wasn't at fault. And so... So I realized at one time, you know, that I didn't show up for the marriage and I wasn't there, and she wanted to do things, you know, she wanted to hang out with other couples with kids, and I was so anxiety ridden, I was like, I can't do that. I can't do that, you know. So I just like to stay in my routine, and I have a group of friends, and I was part of a group of artists and stuff. We hung out all the time and that was fine, but meeting new people just freaked the hell out of me, just like going on the retreat. Where am I going to stay? So I went over there to tell her, I said, look, I just need to apologize to you for not showing up in a marriage. I said, I need to tell you this. And she said, the whole thing was my fault. And I said, no, I mean, seriously, I know what you wanted out of, you wanted a partner, and I was not a partner, and I understand that today. I understand this. And she goes, I thought it was all you, and then I left you, and the same things happened, so it was all my fault. And I was like, you know, and we went back and forth a couple times, and I just said, you know what, for whatever it was that I did, I'm sorry, you know, and I left it at that. And so my mother was dying, and I had to make a decision one day. She asked me never to put a feeding tube or anything in, and I did. And I don't regret doing it. I just know she didn't want to be like that because of how strong and the things she did. But she got to a point where she had broken both her hips and she was getting the dementia. And she'd asked me never to do that, and I did. And because the doctor said if I did that, she would come back, and she never did. And so I made the decision that I was going to take the feeding tube out and, you know, and bring her home with me. I made the decision at a sponsee meeting, and there was quite a few guys who are here tonight who were there. When I made the decision, and it was my turn to speak in a little round robin, and I sat there for 10 minutes and cried because I couldn't say it, that I was going to bring her home to die. And any of you who have done that know that it's the most unnatural experience you'll ever have, because I didn't want to keep giving the morphine because you can get addicted to morphine. But she was only going to live another 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I mean, she wasn't going to live long no matter what. She wasn't feeding, and I was giving her water through a tube. But you give her morphine to keep her comfortable, but that's not what you do to people, because all your life you hear is that morphine is addicting. Well, so those, it's one of the most unnatural things. But I had this group. So I made the decision in that meeting and, you know, walked through it with Willie. And then, I don't think Oscar's here tonight. Oscar had gone through it with his mother. Oscarito! Oscar is here, for those of you who can't see me on the CD. So, Oscar had gone through it with his mother, so he told me what I was going to have to do, and hospice came out, and they showed me. I'm like, when are you guys coming back? And they're like, well, we're here like 3 times a week. And I was like, what the hell do I do other than that? And Oscar said, you've got to clean your mother. I had never thought about the time I was going to be washing my mother's vagina and rear end, and, you know, but that's what I had to do. And I was grateful that I got to do that. Oh, I've skipped a big part of why I got to Al-Anon. My brother is an alcoholic. He has said that. I've heard him say that. He was sober for many years, and he started drinking again and started enacting vengeance on me and my mother. And I had a house that was in his name because he was my best friend my whole life and took care of me. He was my hero my whole life. But at this time, he had got into his disease, and he evicted us from the house. My mother was in a hospital at the time. He sent his wife down to evict her from a hospital bed. So I got, you know, the marshals came and kicked me out of the house. It was my house. I'd paid a mortgage on it in 10 years, but it was in his name. And that was part of the depression and how I got in the house with the windows all covered. So the reason I go back to say that, it's funny because everybody who knows me knows when I came here, all I said was, they say, hi, Brian, this is my friend Eric. I'd say, hey, Eric, my brother stole my house. Hey. Hey, Brian, haven't seen you in a long time. How you been? Oh, I'm good. My brother stole my house. I was in that victim mode, and that's all I could say. Was my brother stole my house. Hey, how's your brother? He stole my house. You know? My brother makes an awful lot of money. He's a wealthy man. And he took everything from me and my mother. And so when she came to die with me, we had nothing. And had he not done that, I would not have had that experience, which was the most beautiful and tragic experience I've ever had in my life. So Oscar came by and he showed me the basics. Where's Randy? There you are. Randy, I didn't know Randy at the time, really. We had been in a circle in the one of the first retreats. I got to know him a little bit. He came by and sat the first shift with me as she was on her little bed in my little living room in my little one-bedroom apartment. And Randy came by and he sat with me. Michael sat with me. Gordon, who passed away, called me every day. Ron called me every day. I talked to Willie. I talked to so many people, you know, who came and supported me and sat with me as my mother was comatose there, dying in my apartment. And I realized at that time that I would never have to go through anything alone again if I didn't want to. And the knowledge of the people in this room who have been through these things before me would walk me through because they had already done it and they would take me through step by step. So my mother was dying and I was in denial, and Oscar said, hey, you better call the priest, man. And, you know, she was going. And so I called the priest and he came down and he was praying for her, and he said, and we pray for Brian. And I just lost it. I just started crying. I said, why is he praying for me? I'm not going through anything, you know? And I'm sitting holding my mother's hand that she's about to pass away. And I didn't understand why he was praying for me. So a few hours later, she passed, and I was holding her on her last 4 breaths. And during that time, it became clear to me exactly who she was and why she did all that when I was a kid. And I thought I had, but I was able to forgive her completely. Everything she did, she thought was going to help me. Even though it didn't work out for me, it was in the goodness of her heart, everything that she did for me in her last 4 breaths. So I was able to, let it go. So I went to the bathroom to get a, you know, some Kleenex to wipe my eyes, and I said, I better check the time. And I have an OCD thing with numbers, and my mother's known this my whole life. And I like 4s, 8s, 16, 32. And I said, oh, I better check the clock to see what time it is so I can tell the the funeral home for the death certificate. And I came out, and the time was 4:44. And I said, thanks, Mom. You know? So that is one of the beautiful experiences that I was walked through by this group of men in here. And so what I had done, since I was in this depression and everything, what I had done is I had kept on my mother's morphine. I had about 100 milligrams of morphine, and I was going to sell it because I did not think I could make a living. I did not have a job. I was really fat. I used to do construction. I was out of shape. I was just in a bad way. And I used to own a delivery service. I had a car, but I couldn't deliver. The car was messed up, and I didn't have any money to fix it. I was just broken. And so I was going to, and I was sponsoring a guy who was in the porn business. And he said there was a lot of people around there that did a lot of drugs. So I was going to sell my mother's morphine for a lot of money. And then I didn't obviously tell my sponsor about it. And I didn't tell anybody about it. So this group of friends that I had made in that year, I didn't tell them all about it. And then after about a month of having the morphine, I called Willie. And I put a dowel down the toilet. And, you know, my impression with people is they would say, of course you can't sell morphine, you idiot. You know, that's the stupidest thing in the world. And he paused and he said to me, I guess you've had a lot of decisions to make. I didn't know about people giving you the dignity to make their own decisions and giving people the dignity to make their own decisions. So, I was learning all about that. At that time. And then I came and I shared about it in the meeting. It was very emotional for me. I stood up. We got about, 80, 90 guys that night. I shared it. I shared about it. And, people were glad to hear that I did the right thing or did the thing I did. And maybe some people think it wasn't the right thing. But, and then Dublin came up to me. Where's Dublin? In the back? What are you doing in the back row? Can you hear me? So Dublin came up to me and he said, I know what it's like to go through something alone. And I was like, oh, that's what I did. By doing that, I shut the support group that had walked me through my mother's death, had walked me through what my brother had done, walked me through everything. I put a wall around me because I knew I couldn't come in here and tell them that I was going to sell drugs that, probably would kill people. You know what I mean? Among other things. And so, he said, I know what it's like to be alone. And I didn't realize that's what I had done. And again, I realized that I would never have to go through anything alone again if I didn't choose to. So, let me make sure I've covered all the bullet points. I'll tell you... I'm making a living amends to my wife, ex-wife. She was moving, and I couldn't help her because I need a new hip. And she got angry at me a couple times. And she's not a shrew, she got angry at me a couple times when I went over there during the moving process. So I just went up to her, and I said, "Can I pay to have the old house cleaned for you?" And she said, she had the look on her face like, what do you want from me? She was like, I don't know, I'm going to have to think about it. And so I said, okay. And I didn't say, what do you have to think about? And I said, okay. And then she called me up a couple of days later and said, are you people ready? And I didn't say, you didn't tell me they want me, you didn't tell me you wanted them to be ready. I said, yeah, and I made sure they were. And I was able to say, she goes, well, are they going to do a good job? And I said, well, that's, you're going to be there to before you give them the money, we're going to, you know, you're going to check off everything. And she had to tell them two or three times things to do. And then she told me that, and I said, I was able to say, it was really good that you were there then. Not to say you have to be there, don't be an idiot, don't not be there, you know. Got a couple stories, I don't know what I want to, anyway. You know, I want to talk about regrets. I know things happen for a reason, and I can say that all the time, but as I get more in recovery and I see what life really is, I wish I would have been a better son. And it doesn't rule my life. You know, I don't sit around every day and punch myself in the head, but I just wish I would have been a better son to my mother. I wish I would have understood my father more, and we could have been on better terms. My parents helped me a lot in their retirement years financially, but that's all they could do. They couldn't love me like I wanted to be loved. And that's today it's okay. They won. I have other people now that love me like I want to be loved, but they couldn't. And I understand that. But I wish I would have understood my father a little better. So we could have, I don't know. I think it was, I was like 45 the first time we hung out for the day. And I told him when I dropped him off, we went to the car show downtown. We came back, said, you know, it's the first time we ever hung out together. I didn't go over the house and stuff, but we went out for the day. And so, you know, those are things that, you know, I live with and I think about. And I understand by making a living amends, being a better father to my son and all these things. I understand this, but I still have those points. I'm going to tell you about working this program. Went out with a woman for a very short period of time and thought she might have a drinking problem. I told this to an ex-girlfriend of mine who's 31 years sober. She said, why did you think that? I said, well, she used to send me pictures at midnight of her drinking alone. Why are you guys laughing? Oh, like you knew. So, for whatever, you know, that being one of the reasons, it didn't work out. But I was able to get out. But I didn't get out as soon as I wanted to because there's that fear of losing something you don't want. That's a fact. So, my sponsor gave me all these things to do. He's like, you got to call her three times. I'm like, you call her three times. Of course, I didn't say that to him. I was thinking, why don't you call her three times? And, you know, and then I had to write something, and then she had texted me later on, said she missed me. You said you miss her, and I said, yes. And he goes, we have to write that. I'm like, I don't want to write it. I want to, you know, I don't want to be a punk until I miss her, you know, after she's gone. And so, so I did. And I got to tell you, it really worked. And then she did something, and I never go on people's Facebook things, ever. I learned that when I was 21 and I read my girlfriend's diary, I assure you, I learned. And there was, you know, just that the stream, whatever they call it, it goes down. I saw the name and I looked at it, and she was dating someone already and calling him the name she called me and referring to herself as the name I called her. And I was like, mother sucker. And it was at night, you know, and I didn't have to call my sponsor at midnight and tell him this. I knew I could just sit with it because I had some recovery, and it didn't feel good. But it felt like I got kicked, you know, because I gave up that thing I didn't want. And so there's a real point to this story. So I called him up the next day, and I go, you know what, man? I am tired of getting this feeling, you know, getting this feeling that someone has done something to you so horribly, and I just don't want it anymore. And he said, well, we got to figure out where the original hurt comes from. And I said, I know where it comes from. I was 13 years old, and this girl had been chasing me all through school, and now we were 13 and developing, and so we went on a camping trip, and She sat on the bus. There was, by the time we got on the bus, it was LA City Parks, went right up to here to Angeles Crest. And there was two separate seats. And so she sat in one with an older guy, he was 15. And I sat over here, and I knew the guy. So when they got off the bus, he took her into a cabin, put up a couple sheets, and raped her. And it happened so fast. My brother was there, and some of his older friends, and they wouldn't have put up with anything. It just happened. It's crazy how fast it happened. And then he threw her out of the bed, and she was crying and bleeding. And it was like, you know, I guess, you know, so what do I think now? Oh, I'm going to make her my girlfriend. And so we did that. I did that. And it was after not that long of a time. I called her up one day, and there was a couple of guys over at her place that I knew. And I said, hey, what's wrong? Don't you love me anymore? And she said, love you? I don't even like you. And I just doubled over and started crying and, you know, screaming. It was like, you know, I remember it like it was yesterday. And so my brother drove me over there to pick up my promise ring, whatever it was. And I came home and I was like mortified. And he said, well, I said, that's the first time. He said, well, write about that. So I just sat down and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. And then I wrote the whole situation as I remember it, again, like it was yesterday, everything that happened. And then when I got to the end, I said, I wonder if she blames me. I wonder if she blamed me. That's why she started hating me. And then I said to myself, I wonder if I blame me. And my head hit my chest. I almost passed out. It was 35 years of, you know, pain that was just relieved. Because I went through a process with someone who just happened to come into my life. And I took that process and what happened, and I went to, we worked this, and then we just went through it through some writing. It just, the miracle of this program is, throughout time, you can solve so many things in your life. You can see them for what they really are. You know, that situation bothered me my whole life, and now it doesn't bother me anymore. I couldn't have done anything, and I know I couldn't have. It's just the way it was. Nobody knew. But I let it sat with me, and I didn't realize what it was until something else had happened and I had worked through it. So, I just about, it was just about, when my, I got a couple minutes, when my wife left, we had a business together, and the state came in and said we owed a lot of money, and it turned out to be $972,000. And it wasn't really our debt. And once they decide you've done it, it's the way it is. So I took all that debt on because my ex was moving with my son, and I didn't want anybody coming to their house and kicking them out. I figured I could take it. And it took me about 8 years to resolve it. And I was just so angry. I just said, you know what? I said, I just wanted to say that. I just want someone to say that I did the right thing. It was 8 years, you know, of getting through this. And I'm finally halfway, you know, through this year. At the end, I'll be done. And I was sitting with my son. He was working at In-N-Out Burger, hanging out by the trash can, smoking. And I said, I just want someone to say you did the right thing. And he looked at me and said, Dad, you did the right thing. It doesn't have to be her, you know? It doesn't have to be my parents. You never know where it's going to come from. I got to thank you again. This is, you know, it's one of the greatest days of my life. I love you guys so much. And I'm just humbled to be part of this group. Thank you very much.
David Kay, please come up. We're going to be at Al-Anon closing.